Holy Gospel according to St. John, the first chapter.
Glory to you, O Lord.
The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, he said of him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." The Gospel of the Lord. What are you going to do when your looks are gone? Seems to be an irrelevant question to ask all of you, not because your looks are already gone, but because I realize that could have been a dangerous place to go, but because you're remarkably good looking and the chances of you losing your looks are slim to none. But what are you going to do when your looks are gone? That's the question asked in a Paul Simon song. Outrageous. Tell me, what are you going to do when your looks are gone? What are you going to do when your looks are gone? Will there be love? Will you be loved? Will you be worthwhile? And Simon answers the question, God will love as God waters the flowers in the flower box. Whether Simon intends it or not, he is able in that song to capture an essence of the Christian gospel. That it isn't about our good looks, of which are abundant here today. It isn't about our remarkable accomplishments, which is also abundant among you today. It's not about your good character, which I've seen expressed in myriads of ways. But finally, the significance of your life is determined by God, who receives you and accepts you because you are his child. We are asked, as we are known by that God, to, through our own lives, mature in our faith to better know that God. And we are also asked to embody in who we are physically that love and that compassion that God has shown to us. There's a story of a young man named Narcissus from mythology. A young man who was remarkable to look at. Probably even better looking than Justin Bieber, I'm guessing. The ongoing battle at my house right now is convincing my son that Justin Bieber is actually a boy. He's not buying that argument yet. A remarkably good-looking young man who knows that he's good-looking. And one day this young man, Narcissus, is passing a pond where the water is calm, and he sees his reflection, and he's overwhelmed by the beauty of his own appearance to the point where he can't walk away from that reflection. And he stays there day and night. And out of compassion for him, the gods look upon him, and they slowly transform him into a flower, which is sort of the folklore about how the Narcissus came into being, so that he could always be planted by the waterside to admire the beauty of his reflection. We have coined a phrase in our modern-day culture called narcissism, which gains its name from this character Narcissus, but I think that there is a significant difference between this young man and what we're talking about today. Please understand that with this young man Narcissus, he was confident of his attractiveness. He was confident of his goodness and his good looks. Now, we may on the surface think that those who are narcissistic, which wouldn't be anyone in this room, but other people that we know that are full of themselves and overly confident with themselves as well. But if you scratch the surface, what you're going to find are people who have been depleted, who have been emptied of self-worth and significance, have been beaten down for whatever reason. And the attempts at calling attention back to themselves are somehow a way to rebuild a fragile brokenness that is so precarious in their lives. In his book, Necessary Endings, James Townsend talks about the approach that people take when they are confronted with something that they have done wrong. And he talks about a mature approach, one that is filled with wisdom, which is a person who has the capacity to hear when confronted that they have done something wrong. That they will sit, they will listen, they will think about it, they will acknowledge what they have done wrong, they will then say out loud that they realize they have done something wrong and will find a way to make an amend in their life. But with less maturity and less wisdom, we have those who react in a very different way when confronted with something that they have done wrong. It is a defensiveness, a defensiveness that's rooted in not having the strength to hear that there's something wrong with them. So they don't listen, they come up with excuses right away, they justify, they rationalize, and there is very little opportunity for change to happen because they are offering excuse after excuse for why they're doing what they're doing. In fact, Townsend says the practice of splitting happens, where they come up with very clear distinctions between what is clearly right and what is clearly wrong, and there is no gray area in between. So what do you do with that sore spot in your life? Do you approach it with wisdom and maturity? Or is there a defensiveness and a reactiveness that kicks in when at some level you are asked to go to that one dark spot in your life that you don't want to go? And certainly you don't want anyone else to go there with you. Listen to what the psalmist writes. Lord, you have searched me out and you have known me. Where can I go to hide from your searching look? Where can I flee to be from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're at the height of heaven. If I go to the deepest part of the earth, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and fly to the farthest limits of the sea, Lord, you are right there and you don't let go of me. If I say to myself, surely the darkness will cover me. If I can hide in the darkness, then and the light will become night. It's so dark nothing can be seen. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day. The darkness is as light to you, that there is no part of our lives that escapes the look of God. And God looks at that with that intense stare that we don't like anyone else to look at us with. But notice what else is in the eyes of God. A love for you. God is not rejecting you when God sees that part of your life. Would we so willingly accept the word of God? But in order for us to fully hear of God's gracious acceptance of who we are, we rebel against that every step of the way. We will reject the very goodness of God until we see God crucified, until we bring out our worst and try to put a stop to what God is trying to accomplish. But we've done our worst, and God has not abandoned us. We have reached the lowest point in our lives, and God turns death into life. Brothers and sisters, God knows you. God sees you. And God is saving you. God knows us before we know God. But now, as God has known us, we are called by God to grow in knowing who God is and what God does. And that is a lifelong process of growth. Henry Nouwen reflects sort of that developmental process of growing in our faith by talking about each sort of age development and how we can leave at that moment with an understanding of God that doesn't grow any further. For example, he talks about what happens from those who are infants to about 3 years of age. And one of the challenges that children from 0 to 3 face is the reality that they are not the center of the universe. That's hard for tiny children. And with that comes the ability to use words. And I think it's always ironic that as parents, we can't wait till our children to learn how to talk and then to walk. And then what do we do next? We want them to sit down and be quiet. But coming together, this ability to use words to get what you want because you're the center of the universe. And we can carry with us an infant understanding of God from that point forward, that if I just pray in the right way, God will give me what I think I want. we can carry that through even to the point of our old age and our death. From that 3 to 5 year age span, first of all, the child starts to take on the parent's values. And unfortunately, my son's taking on my wife's values and not mine. And so he's really destined for trouble as he gets older. But the other thing that children start to realize is that their parents are not perfect. You know, it used to be that parents could fix anything, do anything, make anything right, and those moments when all of a sudden the parent can't fix the broken toy. The parent can't make it right. The parent, in a moment of frustration, raises his or her voice. I recognize that moment with my son when he had been playing with a friend and he came home and he said, "You know what? I think I like my friend's dad better than you. Because he's more fun and you're mean." And I said, "I'm glad to hear that, because if you think I'm mean, that probably means that I'm being a good dad to you right now." But with that comes that sense of the ideal expectations of what life can be like. And we can live with that naivete for the rest of our lives. That if we just believe in God, everything will be perfect. Those elementary years are fascinating years, because at that point the child is leaving the safety and the security of the home now and goes on to write, is experiencing all kinds of values from other children and from teachers and other adults. And bringing all of these together and experiencing life outside of that safe environment of home. And what happens at that point is, in that discomfort, those things that make the child uncomfortable really start to be interpreted as those things that are wrong. And the things that make the child comfortable are interpreted as those things that make the child that must be right. And so a real judgmentalism kicks in at this point. A judgment against anything that brings about discomfort or challenge, and an open acceptance of anything that makes a person feel good. We can carry that through the rest of our faith lives as well. That judgmentalism of anyone who is different, who disagrees, who challenges us, who puts us at a sense of discomfort. I think the teenage years are extraordinarily difficult years for our young people. Because at that point, the focus shifts from what people are doing outside of us to what's going on inside of us. And we start noticing things about ourselves that don't make us feel so good. We may not be as pretty, or think so anyway. We may not be as athletic, or we think so anyway. And these desires and these urges start flooding through our body. It shows us the sort of the underside of human life. And if you have had a God all of your life that is a God who is perfect and good and allows no room for any problems, there's a real challenge for you to believe in that God when you are aware of what's going through your heart and your mind at that time. Carries on with us into our adulthood. Young adults leave home and now get to test and to try things, to experiment, to write hypotheses and defend those hypotheses in their college, and all of a sudden things aren't as sure as they used to be. Things aren't as confident as they used to be. And if you have a problem with things that aren't as sure and confident as they used to be, then you're going to have a problem with God. Because God continues to exist outside of the ways that we can understand and imagine God. And all these pieces come to fulfillment in our own adulthood when we are challenged to integrate all of those pieces into our lives, what it means to be a person, what it means to be in relationship with other people, what it means to be contributing to society, what it means to be part of all of the society's conversations. To bring those pieces together. And Alan says the biggest challenge for us as adults is that many times we find ourselves filled with boredom. And anytime we are filled with boredom, we are tempted by impulse, that quick movement that charges things up for us in our lives. But there is a life and a creativity and a vitality that comes from being an adult. As God knows you intimately to the core of who you are, God calls, God invites you to start knowing who He is. To grow and mature in your wisdom and in your faith. And continue to open your minds to how amazing God is. This maturing is embodied. It is embodied in our physical presence. It is embodied in who we are as a human being, which is why Paul then picks up on this piece of human sexuality. There's a wonderful short story in a collection by Flannery O'Connor that shows these two young girls who just come back from parochial school, and they're sitting on the front step of their door, and they're giggling, and finally their aunt asks them, "Why are you giggling?" And they said, "This is because of what Sister Perpetua taught us at school today. She taught us that if we ever find ourselves in a situation where a young man is asking us to compromise ourselves, this is what we are supposed to do. We are supposed to look at him in the eye and say, 'Stop, sir, I am a temple of the Holy Ghost.'" And your giggles reflect the giggles of those girls. That will simply saying that line bring a stop to that relationship? I dare say no. But it does challenge us to look at how we define that physical intimacy between people. What Paul is talking about is a practice among elite males of his day, where it was socially acceptable for elite males in Paul's day who were married to have a mistress or a prostitute. And it was a sign of their status, it was a sign of their power in the community. And there were men in the Corinthian church, in the Christian community, who had these mistresses and prostitutes. And it was becoming a problem in the community because they were seen as being more powerful because of these relationships they had with these women. He takes a look at physical intimacy between two people and looks at how power taints that relationship. And if you think about the way that we look at each other and the words we use to talk about our physically intimate moments, there are words of power. The guy has to be chiseled, fit, muscular, just like a soldier. Who talks about his prowess, uses words of what he has done to somebody else or words of what was done to him, and speaks of his conquests. We define that intimacy in forms of power, where the other person exists merely as an object for my satisfaction. But a warrior will lay down his weapons at two times in his day. One, when he is eating at a table, and second, when he lays down in his bed. That this intimacy is about a complete vulnerability of one person to another. It is a risk that we take with one other person, trusting in that person's love for us, and that we will not be seen as an object. That is one of the reasons why I believe the church teaches that physical intimacy between two people is best expressed in a marriage relationship. Because it is with a person with whom you have made a covenant that you have grown to trust and with whom you are willing to take the risk. God knows you, the depth of your soul, and yet God has not let go of you. And God calls and God invites you to get to know him better each day and to mature in your faith and to embody what you believe in your own physical presence in the world. It's what Thomas A. Kempis writes, "The highest and most useful lesson is to truly know yourself and to think humbly of yourself, making nothing of yourself and always having a good opinion of others is a sign of great wisdom and of great maturity." Amen.